Today's guest, Phil Giraldi, is a former CIA case officer and Army intelligence officer who spent 20 years in Europe and the Middle East working on terrorism cases. He holds a BA with honors from the University of Chicago and MA and PhD in modern history from the University of London. Phil has been a contributing editor for the American Conservative for the past 9 years and writes as well for the UNS Review, in which 2 weeks ago his article, "Did Iranian Weapons Kill Americans? Another Phony Argument Against a Deal with Iran." He's also the executive director of the Council for National Interest and resides with his wife of 32 years in Virginia, where I reached him a moment ago. Welcome once again to Takes on the World, Phil Giraldi.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on again.
It's glad to have you back here. You know, you've been around for a while and have observed the activities of the Israel lobby on Capitol Hill as much as anyone. Have you ever seen anything like the campaign AIPAC and the other leading pro-Israel groups, think tanks, are waging to kill the Iran agreement?
Well, no, I haven't. There are some estimates as high as $100 million will be spent on this campaign. AIPAC alone is apparently going to come up with $40 million. It depends, of course, on where you live, because they're targeting congressmen that they consider to be undecided. So we're seeing a lot of ads in the Washington area on television, also on radio, even on the internet, and I'm sure that's also the case in New York. This is an all-out effort to stop the deal with Iran, and they've really committed every resource they have to it.
In your article, you brought up another issue that I hadn't been aware of, that they were trying to blame Iran for U.S. casualties in Iraq. And the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, AIPAC spawn, to use the most pejorative word I can for it, seems to be behind it. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Yeah, they've organized a group of alleged veterans who were wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're doing a bunch of pieces that appear various places in the media, alleging that it was Iranian-provided weapons and direction from the Iranian government to kill Americans in Iraq, most particularly. The whole argument is quite ridiculous if one considers that we were the ones who invaded Iraq. This has gained a certain amount of traction because of the image of a badly wounded American with his scars saying, "Yes, the Iranians killed my buddies and did this to me."
Well, you know, there's a mantra that seems to be going around even by those who have defending the deal, that Iran is a leading state sponsor of terrorism in the Middle East, which they don't provide really examples of this. But when one looks around, first the United States, Israel, and the Saudis, and look at Qatar, who has been supplying the weapons for ISIS? Who has been supplying?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you could comment on that and the whole idea of trying to frame Iran, an image about Iran. It's obviously no democracy, but a certain image to justify whatever is going to be done against it.
Yeah, well, Iran, in fact, has been resisting ISIS and al-Qaeda, whereas our good friends Israel, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia have been supporting them. Some Israeli officials have stated that they would prefer to see anarchy in Syria, which means supporting ISIS, basically, as opposed to having a unified government there, which could create problems for them. And the Saudis and Qataris have, for their own reasons, been supporting ISIS. They've been supporting al-Qaeda. And then, of course, we have the Turks, who are playing their own game. They're pretending to be supporting ISIS, but ISIS, of course, is using their Turkey as a resource, as a supply base, has been raising money there, has been selling oil there, and the Turks have been using this war against ISIS as a pretext to bomb the Kurds.
Well, also, you see even statements by Netanyahu that ISIS is not the problem, Iran is the problem. It's like his access to American television seems to be unparalleled. In all my life, I've never seen a foreign leader, and Netanyahu is not an American. He's a leader of a foreign country that interests are in conflict with the United States, obviously, at the moment. And yet the U.S. media, television, Sunday talk shows, give him and those his surrogates carte blanche to carry on this propaganda war against Iran. I've described it in a previous program as a sort of coup.
Yeah, I guess you could call it that. He's on nearly every Sunday here in the Washington area on television, and he's interviewed frequently by NPR. And as you say, his surrogates are everywhere. There's a feature piece in the Washington Post this morning against the deal with Iran that's written by David Petraeus. And basically, Petraeus is coming out on the side of saying that Iran is a threat to the United States and so on and so forth. You wonder how this guy got that high in the military if his perception of threat and everything is as he seems to be expressing it.
We remember that Petraeus made a statement, a written statement to a Senate committee in which he blamed Israel's occupation of Palestine as causing problems for American troops in the Middle East, and then he had to backpedal and apologize.
Right.
And since that time, he's become a lapdog for the lobby. And, of course, he's been under indictment, or I don't know what the latest status is, but he didn't go to jail for doing what other people have gone to jail for, by giving away military secrets.
Yeah, he paid a fine, whereas other people for doing less had to go to jail for 30, in case of John Kiriakou. The whole thing is there's a hypocrisy here that is astounding. This piece by Petraeus was co-authored by Dennis Ross, who I'm sure you've discussed numerous times on your show
this morning.
Sometimes referred to as Israel's lawyer.
Well, actually, the Israel lawyer, he was called by Aaron David Miller, who was another, in fact, Israel's lawyer, who worked with Ross as a so-called negotiator of peace agreements or attempted peace agreements with the Palestinians. But Ross was not reported in the American media, but Ross has advised Washington to send a bunker buster, the kind of bunker buster bombs that the U.S. would use to bomb Iran, to Israel along with the airplanes and the training, so Israel could carry on an attack on Iran should it choose to do so.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting. These are the 30,000-pound bunker busters, because Israel already has the 5,000-pound version, and they want to give them the 30,000-pound version together with the heavy bombers to carry them, and as you say, the training to use them. And this, of course, is not in our interest. We're basically trying to come to terms with Iran after more than 30 years of hostility. And essentially, this is not in any American conceivable interest. But yet, if we give Israel these weapons, and the report from Ehud Barak last week suggests that that Netanyahu was prepared to attack Iran. So it's not just a fantasy that if he has these weapons, he won't use them. He will use them.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier in the program that Barak releasing tapes of recorded conversations on Israeli television, which would technically be a violation of the law, but there's obviously some political reason to do so and get away with it, but that we hear constantly about Iran threatening the annihilation of Israel, and yet it's Israel is the one that's actually planning to attack and has the capability of attacking Iran. It's like hypocrisy, and yet the New York Times did not see fit to print that story.
No, they didn't. And the Times last week was had a front page piece that I'm sure you saw, which basically was allegedly supporting the nuclear deal with Iran, but everybody quoted in the article was in fact a critic of it. So it was kind of, you know, if you read the article, then
I did.
The headline, they were quite different. Yeah,
I did. I actually watching the media build up reminds me very much of the media build up before the Iraq War, and some of the same characters have their bylines in there. It's like nobody paid the price for the Iraq War. Would you think there would have been a possibility of this Islamic State without the U.S. invasion of Iraq?
No, I don't think so. I think that we see a classic case of a power vacuum having created certain consequences. And the consequences basically were to empower radical movements in Syria, which have now spilled back over into Iraq. And indeed, they were already spilling back over into Iraq shortly after the invasion of Iraq by the United States. The United States is culpable for a lot of things, and I'm sure you've discussed this in the past on your show on a number of occasions. The whole creation of al-Qaeda as a result of U.S. intervention in Afghanistan against the Russians, essentially, against the Soviets, helped create al-Qaeda, and now we're seeing a replay of that very same situation. You create a power vacuum, you pump a lot of weapons into the situation, you build up a lot of support mechanisms and that sort of thing, and what do you get?
Well, you see also what happened with the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya and the capture of the stores of weapons that he had and how those spread to Syria and also into Central Africa. It's like everything that the United States and the NATO allies touch seems to be a Pandora's box of evil. It doesn't come back really to hurt us directly or even in Europe directly, the Charlie Hebdo incident being relatively minor compared to what's been going on in North Africa and Central Africa and so on. And yet there's no discussion of this or recognition of this in any of the discussions on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that's amazing. If you go so far as to watch the hearings that the Senate Foreign Policy Committee and the House equivalent call, they all call in experts that come from AIPAC or WINEP or from some defense contractor-funded think tank like the American Enterprise Institute, and these people all say the same thing, which is essentially they are looking for enemies to justify their own existence. And that's what they succeed in doing. And, of course, the congressmen eat all this right up. I mean, that's what they're interested in, too. I mean, so it's quite an amazing procedure. They never, ever have a critic, just like on the Sunday morning news broadcast that we were talking about. Netanyahu will be on. Joe Lieberman will be on. John McCain will be on. But you and I will not be on.
Well, it's interesting. My guess is Phil Giraldi, we're talking about the Iran agreement situation, the opposition to it, is that there was an organization started by a man named Gary Seymour, who was a nuclear advisor for Obama, and I think he also may have been in the Bush administration, United Against Nuclear Iran, and he was the president of the organization, but gradually became taken over by pro-Israel or Israel firsters. And he came out in support of the agreement with Iran and consequently resigned as president of the organization he helped to found because he opposed his position. That should have been a major story.
Yeah, it should have been a major story. He was Samora has been around for a long time, and you're right, he dates back to the Bush administration. And he's always been kind of a technocrat kind of guy. And I think he sincerely believed for various reasons that Iran was, you know, many people in the intelligence community actually do believe or did believe that Iran was moving towards a nuclear weapon and doing so in secret, and that it was an area of some concern. So he was kind of on that page. But the fact is, you know, as we learn more and more about Iran's non-program, that argument has kind of faded away. And I think that's what happened to him, where he finally said, well, look, this is not a serious argument anymore, and I'm going to dissociate myself with him. And you're right, it should have been a big story, but it wasn't.
And that he was replaced by Senator Joe Lieberman, one of the sleaziest people who ever sit in the U.S. Senate. And that says something because there's a lot of competition for that title. Lieberman has called in the past for the U.S. to bomb Iran. I mean, it's like him and McCain and Lindsey Graham, the three musketeers, traveled around the world together finding ways to, they embraced, I think Al-Nusra Front in Iraq, mm-hmm. or in Syria, rather.
Right.
And yet they're never called on it by these patsies who pretend to be talk show hosts.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things. I don't watch these shows very much because they make me sick. But the fact is that they never get challenged. You have people like Stephanopoulos there who are they're not dopes, and they understand the issues and they understand what's going on, and yet they never challenge these clowns in any serious way. And that's one of the really sad things about American journalism, that here we have the Fourth Estate, which should be, to a certain extent, applying pushback against a lot of these warmongers, but the fact is they don't.
Well, it's interesting. Earlier in my program, before I called you, I played a two-minute clip from an extraordinary interview between John Hockenberry of The Takeaway and Senator Robert Menendez, an indicted criminal who's still a power in the Senate. Who has come out, of course, in opposing the Iran deal because he's a former architect of the sanctions and has received millions of dollars of support from pro-Israel donors. But Hockenberry actually challenged Menendez and suggested he was acting in Israel's behalf, not America's behalf, and asked him why he didn't support the Goldstone Report. And actually accused Menendez of using rhetoric when he replied. This was kind of a breakthrough that you will never hear on NPR or, for that matter, any other radio program. And I listened to that, and I played that snippet for our listeners here. We played The Takeaway early in the morning from 6 to 7. But that was a extraordinary moment when an American senator whose diehard support for Israel is actually challenged by an American journalist.
Well, that is remarkable. In fact, I would love to hear that.
It's actually, you go back to The Takeaway for August. We could go Wednesday. We could go today, and you'll hear that, and it's extraordinary. It's an eight-minute interview, and most of it is Menendez regurgitating the AIPAC line, and then when he gets a chance to get a word in, Hockenberry goes after him, and Menendez is not ready for it. It's quite interesting, but it is a rare moment for American journalism where you do not hear. I mean, it's like, almost like a Jon Stewart cameo shot. Stewart might do that, but hearing Hockenberry do that was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I would love to hear it. That's refreshing to hear that it happened even once.
Now, one of the things that's happened is that a positive thing. You may have seen that ad in the New York Times last week, signed by 26 former Jewish organization leaders, including Tom Dine, who built AIPAC into what it is today, supporting the deal. And to me, it reflects a fear and a concern and some anger by American Jews who see the idea of an Israeli prime minister telling American Jews that they must support him against the president. Raises the whole issue of dual loyalty, makes a number of people quite uncomfortable, and I think they felt obliged to make that statement in the New York Times to put themselves on record that they are not going to follow Netanyahu's orders. Did you see that ad by any chance?
Yeah, I did, and of course there was also an ad by a large number of rabbis making the same point, that, and also the additional point that that Israel is not necessarily Judaism. It's nice to see this stuff, but I think a lot of it is driven to a certain extent by the wrong reason, and the wrong reason is that I think these, particularly the leaders of the Jewish organizations, are concerned that if Jews as a group get identified with this policy, and the policy leads to a refusal to accept this agreement with Iran, and eventually a catastrophic war, they think that is very bad for Jews in general. And of course, they're right.
They're right.
I think that's probably how they're thinking of it. But the fact is, they should be supporting the agreement on its merits. It's not a question of Jewish Americans or Italian Americans or any other kind of hyphenated Americans. It's a question of, this is an agreement that's good for the United States, and by the way, it's also good for Israel. But the fact is that should be their focus. Is this something that's good for my country and my people? And I would have preferred to see that kind of argument.
Right. As I mentioned, that they had to put in the ad the repetition of this thing of Iran as a leading state sponsor of terrorism. But, that particular phrasing has become an accepted fact. And I was really upset. I shouldn't have been upset. By now I should be expected it to come from any source. But I read it in the New Yorker some weeks ago, and the person who wrote that phrase was that Steve Call, who was a dean of journalism at the Columbia School of Journalism. Now, it's one thing for some hack journalist to put that in the New York Post or the New York Times, but for the head of the Columbia School of Journalism to repeat the same kind of pap without any examples really shows the state of American journalism and how much enthrall it is to the Israeli narrative of what happens in the Middle East. And I mentioned earlier, and before I called you, that the most critical decisions facing America today is who is going to run U.S. Middle East policy and what is it going to be? Because we've had Republican candidates threaten to, like Marco Rubio, they're all, I can use the term whoring for the money that Chetlin Adelson is going to spread around to the Republican Party, that they will overturn, or if this deal goes through, that they will renege on it right away. And the chances are we could have a war with Iran next year or after the elections. Well, what do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think any of the Republican candidates will be a disaster. Now the question becomes, will what they're saying now or what they'll be saying next year necessarily translate into a war? They hopefully some of them will be a bit more restrained once they're actually in power, but I wouldn't put a whole lot of money on that. I think that the chance of a war go up dramatically. And as for your earlier comment about the failure of the media and the failure of journalism, the media, to a certain extent, is reflecting the U.S. government on this issue of Iran as a terrorist state. The U.S. government has for years been saying that Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism, and yet the evidence is not there. I mean, they're taking Iranian support of what are essentially resistance movements against Israel and conflating that with terrorism. And they're also assuming that Iran is directing these groups, which there's no evidence for whatsoever. So, you know, this whole argument is a bit shaky, and yet it's something that prevails because people are comfortable with it, and they're comfortable with seeing it because it supports their own prejudices.
Well, they like to think of Hezbollah as being simply an Iranian proxy, as the Vietnamese were a Chinese or Russian proxy, as a Nicaraguan Sandinista were Russian proxies. It's a lot easier, and it was the reverse as well. It's a lot easier to dismiss people struggle for their rights as being someone else's proxy, as if what they're fighting for had no legitimacy. But I've spent time in Lebanon, and those people are sons of the soil. They're also not Iranian. They're Arab, and they're fighting for their land, not for Tehran's ayatollahs. And one of the things that I've mentioned before on the air that is never mentioned in the U.S. media is that Hezbollah has been in alliance with a leading party, Maronite Christian Party in Lebanon, for a number of years, led by a former president and general, Michel Aoun. And I spoke with Aoun back in 2007, the last time I was there, and he told me quite frankly that were it not for Hezbollah, Israel would take over Lebanon. And not only is his party, the Free Progressive Movement, supporting an alliance with Hezbollah, but also some smaller Christian parties are as well. And the only Christians that are opposing Hezbollah are the ultra-right wingers who were involved in terrorist acts during the Lebanese Civil War. None of this is ever discussed or mentioned in the U.S. media.
Yeah, well, it's because it would be too complicated. Just as I would fear that Washington or in the White House, National Security Council, they only have a fairly dim grasp of this too. The problem is once something runs against the established wisdom or the groupthink, if you want to put it that way, they have a difficult time even finding it on their plate. I mean, they just cannot do it, and that's to me like I wrote a piece that appeared yesterday in the American Conservative on Turkey and what's going on there. And it's very clear for someone who kind of knows about Turkey to understand that the Turks have been screwing us on this deal for a long time. They've been out to destroy the Kurds, and they're using these. But the fact is that Washington doesn't want to hear that. They prefer to hear, oh, yes, well, the Turks are with us in the war against ISIS and so on and so forth, because that's a more comforting kind of narrative.
But they're not fighting ISIS. They're fighting the Kurds.
Exactly.
with our weapons.
With our weapons.
You know, it's what's really interesting is what there's nothing that shows more of a greater example of how these sanctions against Iran, going back to Iran, are Israeli and American manufactured by the rush of European businesses anxious to do business with Iran, and would have been doing so had it not been for their need to use U.S. banks, and that we have a special department in the U.S. Treasury, which is run by pro-Israeli Jews, who have been responsible for monitoring all these companies around the world that might dare to break the sanctions and do some business with Iran. And one of the criticisms being made of this deal with Iran is that in 15 years, which is quite a long time, a lot of things happen in 15 years, that there'll be so much European business with Iran that Iran will be able to establish build a nuclear weapon without the West being able to do anything about it, assuming that that's what Iran wants to do, but there's no evidence that they want to do it. And the fact here, you have a country that will be doing business with the whole world, which is the last thing that Israel wants to see. Right? Maybe comment on that.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah. And, of course, the assumption is that in 15 years' time, after Iran is opened up to the world and is doing business with the world, that it will be the same Iran, this Iran that they've characteristically seen as a terrorist supporter, as a disruptive presence in the Middle East, and so on and so forth. I mean, Iran is going to change in 15 years, too. I mean, opinion polls consistently show that the young people in Iran are not on the same wavelength as the aging leadership. And in 15 years, it will be a different country.
Well, this is something that they're actually afraid of. I mean, they like to...
Yeah, of course.
And this is why they would like to have a regime change of their own design at the moment. Getting back to the elections, my guest is Phil Giraldi. We're talking about Iran and what's happening in the environs there and the agreement. If Hillary Clinton, although she appears to be more damaged goods every day, but she's been pretty much of a hawk. She was more of a hawk on Libya than was the president. If she becomes the president, has been, of course, supported by Haim Saban. She bragged about being one of Haim's Power Rangers. What do you think the chances of a U.S. attack on Iran or supporting an Israeli attack on Iran would be?
Well, I think the probability goes down considerably. I think Hillary is smart enough to realize that that a war is not a good idea, just in terms of the probability that once you get into that process, things tend to go bad. And she, of course, would know that personally from what happened in Libya. So I suspect that Hillary would have a serious aversion to going to war. But short of that, Hillary is basically owned by the Israel lobby. And I suspect that everything short of that, Israel will be doing their bidding, which means the Palestinians will be in a very bad place. What minor openings Obama has kind of made to them, or hints that he's dropped about possibly supporting statehood in a certain way, you won't hear that kind of stuff from Hillary.
You know, it's earlier before I called you, and we had spoken briefly on the phone, in my commentary before I called you, I examined the positions of Noam Chomsky, who is like the guru for the liberal left, and that he finally broke his silence in writing about the Iran agreement. And Well, actually, the article was to show that it was the U.S. is the gravest threat to peace, not Iran. But it's extraordinary that in the article there was absolutely no mention of Netanyahu, of AIPAC, of the Israel lobby, all this money and pressure being brought to bear to defeat the deal. And if anyone was not aware of what was going on and read that, they would believe that the Obama administration was also against the deal. How do you account for this myopia upon segments of, let's say, the Palestine Solidarity Support Movement that over the years has refused to acknowledge the power and influence of Israel lobby on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, it's you see it over and over again, and Chomsky is one of the worst. I mean, Chomsky basically sees everything in terms of American imperialism and capitalism. And if you read that article you're referring to, he refers to Israel, I think, about three times, but each time it's in the context of Israel basically being, in a way, the victim of the United States, being used by the United States to promote these policies that are actually policies that are generated here. Well, of course, that's nonsense. Anybody who's watched the situation has seen the reverse. But there's a big problem with the left in terms of how they perceive this issue. The too many organizations on the left, and I would cite groups like Code Pink where essentially they get up to the point where they're anti-war, but all of a sudden they crunch up against Israeli legitimacy and Jewish identity issues. And when they get to that point, suddenly they back off. Code Pink, for example, if you go to its website, it says basically that if Israel bombs Iran, then we will do certain things. We will support sanctions. But, you know, you're going to do this after they bomb Iran? I mean, they're only one example of many others. And many of the other groups that are kind of more Palestinian-focused and that sort of thing, they're wrapped up into this progressive ideology where they don't want to be seen to look like they're criticizing their Jewish allies. And there are times when you have to single out and talk about these so-called Jewish allies, because these Jewish allies are ultimately not helping.
They're providing damage control for a very powerful force that actually doesn't represent them, but there's this fear that to talk about Jewish power, to talk about the Israel lobby, is to provoke anti-Semitism. But the question is, how many more lives of Palestinians, Lebanese, and so on are going to be sacrificed on that altar when the issue, when it's generally recognized that the lobby doesn't represent the majority of Jews. The majority of Jews, in fact, support the Iran deal, but there's this fear of speaking out that takes people, let's say, off stage and allows groups like AIPAC or Washington Institute, the American Jewish Committee, the lobby State Department, to have the floor. And politicians are not held to the same standards for supporting Israel as they were when they supported apartheid South Africa.
Yeah, that's right. And that's essentially what happens. Somehow the debate goes up to a certain point where we all accept we don't want war. And most people say, gee, the Palestinians should have a state right beside the Israeli state. But the fact is that, you know, they don't take the next step, which is that there are powerful Jewish organizations in this country which essentially have dominated the narrative, have the resources, have access to Congress, access to the media, and you have to call these people out for what they are. They're Jewish. I mean, you know, they talk about the evangelicals, but the evangelicals have very limited access to our media, to our political system, and it's really these big Jewish organizations that are behind everything that we're seeing out there, and you have to call them out for exactly what they are.
Well, I've done this on the air, and I think it's really important. It's very difficult to do this conversation that we're having could not be probably take place at any other radio station because of the same sensitivity, worrying about funders and so on. But I've mentioned on the air, Mendocino is not Israeli occupied territory. Phil Giraldi, it's been great talking to you again. Look forward to the next time, and let's hope that this deal is not sabotaged by this very powerful interest that no one wants to talk about.
Thanks for having me. very much, Jim.
Take care, Phil. Bye-bye. And that was Phil Giraldi. And this is Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.